Welcome to Echo Tones. I'm Joy LaClaire. On October 27th, 2022, attorneys for two environmental organizations, Wild Earth Guardians and Project Coyote, a project of Earth Island Institute, filed a lawsuit against the state of Montana by and through the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission. The suit was filed in Montana First Judicial District Court in Lewis and Clark County. It alleges that the state's wolf hunting and trapping policies violate the Montana Constitution, Montana Administrative Procedure Act, the Public Trust Doctrine, and several federal laws meant to protect wildlife on federally managed lands. On November 10, 2022, a motion was filed asking the court to prohibit the start of the state's wolf trapping season, as well as immediately halt the ongoing wolf hunting season while the merits of the lawsuit are being considered. The conservation groups filed the time-sensitive motion with the wolf trapping and snaring season set to begin on November 28, 2022. The hunting season began in September. This motion asks the court to issue a temporary restraining order followed by a preliminary injunction to stop all recreational killing of wolves in the state pending resolution of the lawsuit. In the 2021-2022 season, 273 wolves were killed by hunters and trappers, including 19 Yellowstone wolves, with nearly 70% of the wolves killed after the trapping season began. As of November 10, 2022, hunters had already killed 55 wolves, while regulations permit hunters and trappers to kill an additional 395 wolves before the season ends in March 2023. The motion alleges that the conservation group's interests will be harmed beyond repair if the court allows the hunting and trapping season to proceed while they fully litigate their case. The motion and the underlying lawsuit claim that there are significant flaws in the population model used to estimate the total number of wolves in the state, and that since the quota of 456 wolves for this season relies upon a flawed population model, reaching the quota could have devastating consequences on the state's wolf population. The motion states, quote, "Montana does not have an accurate picture of how many wolves are living in Montana and cannot sustainably and legally manage this species through another wolf hunt this winter," end quote. A listener asked us to investigate, and we share interviews with four people knowledgeable about the issues: Lizzie Pennock, an attorney with Wild Earth Guardians; Greg Lemon, administrator of MFWP's Communication and Education Division; Pat Byarth, Montana Fish and Wildlife Commissioner for Region 3, and Michael Wasagijig Price of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, which joined six tribes who sued the state of Wisconsin in September of 2021 to prevent further wolf slaughter there. Welcome to Echotones, Lizzie Pennock. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Joy. Thanks for having me.
Lizzie, on October 27th, 2022, Wild Earth Guardians and Project Coyote, a project of Earth Island Institute, filed a lawsuit in the Montana State Court alleging that the state's extreme anti-wolf hunting and trapping policies violate the Montana Constitution, Montana Administrative Procedure Act, MAPA, Public Trust Doctrine, and several federal laws meant to protect wildlife on federally managed lands. What are people calling it so we know what to say?
Typically, the first plaintiff name is what the case ends up being called. But in a lot of articles, I've seen it as the Wild Earth Guardians-Project Coyote lawsuit. Project Coyote has been absolutely instrumental in helping us get this case along.
In terms of how it's referred to in the legal community, is it Wild Earth Guardians v. State of Montana?
Yeah.
Let's get to the allegations that Wild Earth Guardians and Project Coyote claim in the suit.
We have five claims. The first claim, we are alleging that, I'm going to call them the respondents, but it's the State of Montana, Fish, Wildlife, and Parks, and the Fish and Wildlife Commission that they collectively violated the Montana Administrative Procedure Act, or MAPA, and the state constitution because they started to use a new wolf population estimate model and effectively amended the 2002 wolf plan to incorporate that model, but they didn't follow the proper rulemaking procedures, which would have included scientific review and public participation. The second claim is that Montana violated state law because it established this quota of 456 wolves to be killed recreationally this year, this winter, and that they issued the wolf hunting and trapping licenses based on the reliance of a stale wolf plan. So essentially, the 2002 wolf plan, by its own terms, is supposed to be reviewed every 5 years. It hasn't been reviewed since it was put in place almost 20 years ago. So it's out of date. And so what we're saying is that it's a violation of state law to rely on that invalid plan as the foundation for issuing hunting and trapping licenses now in 2022. The third claim is a claim that Montana has failed to manage the state's wolf population for the benefit of the public. And we're saying that this violates Montana's public trust doctrine. Our constitution guarantees several things. One of them is that each person has the right to a clean and healthful environment in Montana for present and future generations. And we don't think that wolf management, as it is now happening in Montana since 2021, is guaranteeing everybody the right to a clean and healthful environment. We are alleging that the way the state is now managing wolves is essentially for special interests of a small minority of trappers and wolf hunters. For example, last year, only 10% of hunters in Montana got a wolf license. So even in the hunting community, this is not widely supported. It's not Democrats versus Republicans. It's a very small percentage of people in Montana who support what's going on. And that is not what we are guaranteed. We are guaranteed that our wildlife will be managed for all. So that's the public trust doctrine claim. And then the last two claims are the federal claims. Our fourth claim is that this anti-wolf legislation that was passed in 2021, and then the hunting and trapping regulations approved that year and this year based on that legislation, and the quotas set this year for the 456 dead wolves. We are claiming that those three things interfere with federal policy in the management and administration of national parks in the state, which include Glacier National Park and Yellowstone National Park. The National Park Service is governed by the National Park Service Organic Act, and that act basically requires sound management of wildlife within national park boundaries. And when wolves that spend 95% of their time, for example, in Yellowstone, are then baited 10 feet from the boundary line and shot over bait, which is allowed as of 2021, we're arguing that that is not okay because the federal law governing those wolves preempts the state laws that allow that killing. Federal law supersedes state law. So that's our federal preemption argument. And then the last claim has to do with other federal land management agencies, namely the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. And we're saying the same thing. The 2021 legislation, the regulations, and the quotas of the last 2 years interfere with the federal policy in the management of our national forest lands and our Bureau of Land Management lands, because both of those agencies are also required by law to manage with wildlife in mind and to make sure that multiple uses of land are supported, including supporting viable wildlife populations, which we don't think can possibly happen anymore because of what the state of Montana is doing.
Can you speak to the 2021 laws that got passed to generally inform our listeners of what is legal now and how that's different from what it had been before?
So in 2021, there were four laws passed and signed by Gianforte. I think all of them went into effect April 2021. And they're all designed to reduce the state wolf population. So there's Senate Bill 314, which directed the commission, the Fish and Wildlife Commission, to reduce the wolf population to a, quote, sustainable level. This is troubling because a sustainable level could be as low as 15 breeding pairs of wolves, which is a very small wolf population. That bill also authorized the commission to allow a variety of aggressive hunting tactics not allowed before. The aggressive hunting tactics include things like night hunting, and when you're hunting at night using infrared, the use of infrared imagery, thermal imagery, and artificial lights. This was not allowed before. None of these were allowed before. And these tactics are not allowed for other wildlife species in Montana. Other tactics include snaring, which was approved in House Bill 224, and it requires that the commission allows the use of snares. And this is significant. Before, we could trap for wolves, but snares are particularly dangerous. It's essentially a commercial-grade metal noose that hangs at the level where a wolf's neck would be. And so they run into the snare, and it tightens. So that's a strangulation neck snare. These are incredibly dangerous. They can kill pets. A lot of dogs die in these snares. Dogs die in other types of traps too. They're dangerous for the public. They're dangerous for our pets. They're very cheap. So one person could put out a bunch of snares. They're very difficult to see. So snares on our landscape is incredibly worrying. The third law that was passed in 2021 gave the commission the authority to extend the wolf trapping season. And they did last year and they did this year as well. So it's now, it extends to March 15th, whereas it used to end on February 28th. And it starts a couple weeks sooner as well. This is significant for several reasons. One, more trapping, more snaring means more wolves are going to die. But because the season is extended, it now goes into the times of the year where grizzly bears have not gone into their dens in the fall, in the winter, and it extends into the time where they have come out of their den in March. And grizzly bears can be injured by traps. We've seen grizzly bears have their foot essentially amputated because it got stuck in a trap and that grizzly bear died. Grizzly bears are an endangered species, so this is really troubling. And the commission did change some of the regulations to say that in a near occupied grizzly bear habitat, the trapping season starts a little bit later if based on an on-the-ground decision by an FWP official. But for example, in the Bitterroot, on the Montana part of the Bitterroot ecosystem, where we know we have grizzly bears, but there's no official population of grizzly bears. So that doesn't count as occupied grizzly bear territory, but we would argue that it should. And FWP and the commission do not count it as that either. So there could be traps and snares in the Bitterroot ecosystem where we know for a fact there are grizzly bears, and those grizzly bears have no protection. So the attempt to protect grizzly bears by modifying the trapping season in occupied grizzly bear habitat, it doesn't go far enough. And then the fourth law, Senate Bill 267, allows private parties to offer bounties in exchange for the proof of hunting or trapping wolves. So this can include a reimbursement for the equipment used and other things like that.
Do any of these new laws include things like baiting or aerial hunting or the use of radio telemetry equipment?
Aerial hunting is illegal under federal law, although it was happening last year. But at the commission meeting this year, they clarified this, and one of the commissioners actually asked for this fact that it's illegal under federal law to be put into this year's regulation. So that's not allowed. Baiting is allowed. I don't know off the top of my head if baiting was allowed before last year, but baiting's a huge problem. Again, I don't know if baiting, to what level it was allowed before, but something that's significant now is you can bait a snare, and snares were not allowed before. So that's really concerning.
In the lawsuit, the IPOM model is criticized. First of all, it wasn't in the 2002 Wolf Plan, which hasn't been revised as it was supposed to be every 5 years, nor was it peer-reviewed. What does IPOM stand for, and what does it mean?
IPOM stands for Integrated Patch Occupancy Modeling, and As for what it means, it's a pretty technical descriptor of a certain type of wildlife population monitoring. But we know that that type of method, patch occupancy modeling, is really good for species that travel in herds and that are very abundant across the landscape. This particular type of population modeling is not good for apex predators who are more elusive and less ubiquitous across the landscape. And we highlight pretty heavily that the way that MFWP is using IPOM is unreliable. So essentially, it's a series of models that build on each other to spit out a population estimate. But each model in the series has errors that tend to overestimate the wolf population. So an error in the first layer of this model will then be multiplied in the second layer and again in the third layer. And that's why it's compounding. The errors are compounding. And then some of the issues with this start before we even begin modeling. It's where is FWP getting the data to input into the model? FWP and the commission tout IPOM as allowing them to eliminate field-based monitoring to measure the wolf population, which means that we're not actually getting on-the-ground data observations, which is an essential part of ensuring that a population estimate is reliable. Instead, the IPOM methodology as it's used now relies on opportunistic hunter observations. So we don't have trained biologists out there gathering information. We have hunters who may be able to identify a wolf, or maybe they mistake it for a coyote. And these are just people, some of whom hate wolves and totally agree with what's going on in the legislature. That being said, I think there are plenty of hunters who could accurately identify a wolf and whose data we could rely on. But this is not science. This is not what we should be basing our population estimate modeling on, because it's not completely objective and it's not adequate. And FWP doesn't use this model for any other wildlife population in Montana. And then two of the models in the series tend to overestimate the wolf population. So the first model allows the double counting of wolves that exist outside breeding packs, which are sometimes called floaters or dispersers. The second model can underestimate wolf territory size, which would allow it to assume that more wolves exist in a given area. So two separate models in the series allow for the overestimate of the wolf population, which are then multiplied to get the final estimate.
There have been some changes to the structure and the personnel, which is understandable at both the Fish and Wildlife and Parks administrative level, as well as the commission. And they've gone from using wolf management units to trapping districts. Can you briefly talk about the implications of this change?
The only implication that I can really speak confidently about is the fact that this will allow for less transparency. We are monitoring wolves now and wolf hunting and trapping reports in the 7 trapping districts instead of the many, many more wolf management units that we were monitoring last year. So we'll have less specific data about where wolves are and about where wolves are being killed, which can be incredibly important because wolves are really important parts of their ecosystems and the communities to which they belong. So we can monitor a smaller area, and if a whole wolf pack has been eliminated from that small area, we know that that's something we can be concerned about. But instead now, we're looking at a huge trapping district. If a wolf pack is eliminated from that huge trapping district, we won't know where they were or where we should be concerned about. So it's really the lack of transparency, and it's just less and less specific data about wolf management. So there's also the Wolf Management Unit 313 and 316, which are the units, as they were designated last year, that border Yellowstone. This year, the commission kept Wolf Management Unit 313 and folded 316 in there. So it's the same space as 313 and 316 used to be together, and it's now just called WMU 313. So that's the only Wolf Management Unit left, and that's because those are the wolves that are going in and out of Yellowstone Park. And after the international outcry and, frankly, I think embarrassment of what happened last year with Yellowstone wolves being killed, I think they were a lot more careful this year about what they were going to explicitly allow. And so they kept WMU 313, so they could manage that area kind of independently of the rest of the trapping districts.
Go into that a bit more, Lizzie Pennock, about the wolf management units, the ones that border the northern border of Yellowstone National Park into Montana. Tell us a bit about the history of that, and especially the last year or two.
The context of Yellowstone wolves is these wolves, they got reintroduced in the mid-90s into Yellowstone. But wolves historically, their historic territory includes the entire West, the entire state of Montana. Wolves belong in these ecosystems, and there's a lot of science showing the benefits to the entire ecosystem down to plants of the return of wolves. So it's been this really incredible opportunity to advance science and ecology based on the presence of wolves and see what changed. And not only that, but the Yellowstone wolves are beloved around the world, and millions of people go to Yellowstone often with the intent to see wolves every single year. So it's a huge boost to the economy. It's great for research, and it's something we could all really be proud of. Until last year, I don't think there was a quota, so like a limit on how many wolves could be killed bordering Yellowstone. And that was in the region, including WMU 313 and 316, 82 wolves was the quota. I think that was region 3. They closed it after 85 wolves had been killed. But last year, almost 25% of the Yellowstone wolf population got killed, and most of them got killed in Montana. So it was just really a blight on FWP and the commission to let that happen. And it led to outcry in the state, national outcry, international outcry, and was a huge hit to research on these wolves. A lot of them were collared. So we had been collecting data actively on these wolves. This year at the commission meeting, a lot of people that spoke were really upset about the Yellowstone wolves that got killed last year. And a lot of them are business owners in Gardner and other locations that are kind of gateways to Yellowstone that get a lot of money because of people coming to see those wolves. And they also got, Yellowstone also got hit with the floods that caused a lot of damage. So people were really upset. And that was a good significant portion of the people who commented. FWP had suggested a quota of 10. And apparently Yellowstone National Park supervisors had been in contact with the commission, and this was discussed at the commission meeting, that they had suggested 6 wolves could be killed in the newly minted WMU 313, and that's what the commission did this year. There's one other thing I want to touch on, too. I think it's especially unethical to hunt for these Yellowstone wolves because they spend 95% of their time within the boundaries of Yellowstone National Park, completely protected. And they have these people pointing long-range cameras at them, which to wolves probably look a lot like a rifle. And so when they go over that invisible boundary, they have zero fear of humans. They have zero fear of humans pointing guns at them. And it's just slaughter. This is not fair chase. It's not ethical. And that's just the rifle hunting. Then we can talk about things like baiting wolves over the border, and you can just shoot them over bait, which I think has a whole slew of problems too. But these wolves in particular are not conditioned to fear people.
As we mentioned at the beginning, this suit was filed in Montana's first judicial district court. What does the suit specifically ask for?
We want a couple of things. So we want the court to essentially declare that the wolf hunting licenses issued this year under these regulations, that those are invalid because they're based on the invalid wolf management plan. And we're asking to enjoin the wolf hunting season until FWP and the commission comply with the Montana Administrative Procedure Act. And that would include updating the management plan as it's required to be updated. And that is a public process, so the public could comment and weigh in and be involved with that. And then that would also include putting the IPOM, the population estimate model, through the public process as well, because that would need to be incorporated into the plan. And that would give the public a chance to weigh in on that. So we're trying to vindicate the public's right to participate in the decisions being made about the state's wolves. And then we are asking the court to declare that the regulations, the quota, and the legislation interfere with federal policy, as we discussed before, and that also it's unconstitutional. We have a constitutional right to a clean and healthful environment, which we would argue includes healthy wildlife populations, including wolves. And what's going on and these wolf laws passed in 2021 and the regulations adopted last year and this year, those violate the Constitution. So we're asking for the court to declare that the state violated the public trust doctrine. And then, like I said before, with the two federal law claims, we're asking for declaratory relief. So we want the court to declare that the laws, regulations, and quota are preempted by the National Park Service Organic Act and the laws that govern the other two federal land management agencies. And then we want the court to require the respondents to update the plan. And that would mean that we can have public participation in both the plan and the incorporation of the new population estimate model. The wolf trapping season will begin November 28th, but the hunting season is already underway. It started on September 15th for rifles and September 3rd for archery.
Lizzie Pennock, is there anything else you would like our listeners to be aware of at this time about this case?
This is a really important case. This is not something that a lot of regional or national environmental nonprofits do because it's in state court. But we at Guardians and Project Coyote are just incredibly concerned over what is happening at the state level in Montana. And the reason we filed this suit is because we feel like we can't wait for the federal government to act. We don't know when they will and how many wolves will have died under laws that we're alleging are unconstitutional. And if the court should find in our favor, then all those wolves that died in a snare died under an unconstitutional law. And we just can't sit back and watch these things happen. And we're doing this for the majority of the Montana public who cherish our wildlife and hunters who appreciate a fair chase and hunt for subsistence. This wolf hunting and trapping, it's not feeding anybody. It's not making elk populations any healthier. And it's just unethical. And I think a lot of people here and elsewhere are not okay with that. And so that's why we're bringing this suit and we're going to fight for Montana's wolves anywhere we have to. We're really excited and we're hoping for the best.
If listeners want to find out more or how they can participate in this effort, can you provide them with a way online to do that?
Yes. Listeners can go to wildearthguardians.org. While this case is ongoing, it's on our front page about this lawsuit. People can donate to fund this lawsuit. It's a state court case. So it's being paid for by Wild Earth Guardians and those that support us and Project Coyote and those that support them. So it's really a people power effort and we can use all the help we can get. So donating is huge and that's at wildearthguardians.org. And then you can find me on our staff page. Feel free to send me an email if you'd like to get involved further. I can help potentially with writing a letter to the editor or making your voice heard in another way.
Well, Lizzie Pennock, thank you so much for joining us today on Ecotones. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Joy. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to talk about this incredibly important lawsuit.
Welcome to Ecotones, Greg Lemon, FWP Communications and Education Division Administrator. Thank you for joining us today on Ecotones.
You bet. Happy to be here.
A listener asked us to do a program about Wild Earth Guardians and Project Coyote having filed suit against the state of Montana by and through the Montana Department of Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and the Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission. What has been the response from FWP?
Well, I appreciate the question and certainly the interest. Right now, we can't comment on ongoing litigation.
What can you tell us about the change of methodology guiding decisions to the Integrated Patch Occupancy Model, shortened to IPOM?
We started using IPOM a couple of years ago. As we've evolved our wolf management and our wolf monitoring, we've looked at improving ways to track and monitor wolf numbers, and IPOM is sort of the most recent evolution of that effort. And what IPOM does just broadly is it takes a variety of different sources of monitoring information, including what hunters see when they're out hunting in Montana. We get that through our hunter harvest surveys that we do annually, coupled with lots of other data sources that we have to create the IPOM number. And so the I part of IPOM, it integrated, meaning that we integrate lots of different monitoring sources into the numbers that we come up with for our wolf monitoring, wolf numbers.
I will include in the website posting for this interview a very interesting document that is on the Fish, Wildlife, and Parks website, talking in great detail about the modeling of that. Can you tell me, has that study been peer-reviewed?
It has been peer-reviewed and it has been published.
So the other question that I have is, what prompted the change from wolf management units to trapping districts as a way of keeping track of wolf populations?
Wolf management units were sort of a feature of our early management strategy when we had fewer wolves on the landscape and we were monitoring them at a more local level. With the numbers that we have across the state now, we don't need to manage them on that fine a scale in the wolf management unit scale. And so the commission decided, at the recommendation of the department, to move to a regional or a trapping district management model where the harvest numbers are tracked at a trapping district level. Our monitoring scale is still sort of integrated into that across the state. If you look at our wolf reports that we publish annually, you'll see distribution figures and reports and data that look at it statewide. From a harvest standpoint, managing them at a trapping district level is sufficient. The commission deemed appropriate for the scale of our harvest monitoring.
When did that change occur?
So last season, the 2021 season, we tracked wolf harvest at the wolf management unit level, but the thresholds that were set then were set at a regional level. And those thresholds the commission adopted would prompt a commission review of the wolf season if those thresholds were met. We still tracked harvest at a wolf management unit level, but the thresholds were set at a regional and statewide level.
Has that been met since the 2021 season?
So in 2021, the threshold was met in Region 3, but nowhere else in the state from a regional level. And so when the threshold was met in Region 3, the commission decided to close wolf season at that point, but it wasn't met anywhere else in the state. Just to evolve it to this season, so one of the changes the commission adopted for this season is instead of a threshold, is those regional numbers would be quotas. And so a difference is when there's a quota in place, the commission doesn't come back and decide to close the season. The season closes if that quota is met. It's monitored department-wide, so one of the regulations, if you harvest a wolf, you have to report the harvest at our harvest hotline, so you call it in and report that harvest within 24 hours. That harvest information is automatically entered into a database. That database feeds, we have a public-facing, what we call a dashboard, where anybody can go and see where the harvest has been this year, same with last year. That's how we track where the harvest is compared to a quota. So the wolf dashboard, as it stands today on November 9th, there's been 53 wolves harvested statewide. That number is updated daily, so we look at that number daily to determine, you know, where the harvest level is.
Does the agency have a sense of how compliant hunters are in getting licenses and honoring that, reporting properly? Do you have any sense of delinquency around that?
It's hard to know the answer to that specifically. What I can say is that, by and large, the vast majority of hunters in Montana abide by the laws and the regulations set out by the commission. And unless you catch somebody, it's hard to know if there's people breaking the law or not. And our wardens are across the state are doing their best, and certainly with the help of the public who call 1-800-TIPMONT to report wildlife crimes, they're doing their best to track down crimes when they hear about them or when they discover them. But by and large, hunters in Montana, the vast majority, abide by the regulations and do it the right way.
Greg, is there anything else that you want our listeners to keep in mind about wolves in Montana?
We've had a regulated wolf harvest in Montana for over 10 years, the wolf numbers have grown to the point where they're fairly stable. Right now, around 1,200 wolves in the state by our count. And that's just an estimation because certainly it's impossible to count every animal. But what we can also say is that the harvest levels have been fairly consistent as well. So last year, though there was quite an interest in the changes to the wolf regulations, the harvest for last year was kind of average per harvest level since 2011.
Greg Lemon, thank you so much for joining us today on Ecotones. We appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for the interest.
As promised, Greg Lemon sent me the link to what he said was the published peer-reviewed paper of the IPOM study. But when I went online and tried to read it, there was only the abstract. So I contacted Lizzie Pennock again to ask her about it. Here is what she said.
As we understand it, prior to the upcoming publication that FWP has referenced, there are two models in the IPOM series that have been peer reviewed, and the third series in the model had not been. And also, using all three together, the way that FWP has to count the wolf population had also not been peer reviewed. So that's what they used for the last two seasons that they set regulations for the wolf season, was this model before we're aware that it had been peer reviewed as a whole model. And then one other issue is that there's a big difference between publishing a peer-reviewed paper and then applying the method in the peer-reviewed paper to different data, which would be the new data that they're inputting from wolf hunter observations and other hunter observations. So in order to truthfully say that what FWP is doing to estimate the wolf population, they need to be applying the methodology exactly the same as it was in the peer-reviewed paper. And because we can only see the abstract of that paper and FWP hasn't shared their process with the public, we just don't know if that's what they're doing, if they are applying the methodology exactly like it was in the paper, or if maybe they're doing it a different way.
Pat Byorth, welcome to Ecotones. Thank you for joining us today.
Nice to be with you.
Pat, it says on the FWP website that you were appointed District 2 Commissioner for Region 3 of the Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission in 2017 by Governor Steve Bullock, and you are also Montana Water Director for Trout's Unlimited Western Water and Habitat Project since 2013 as well. Now, is that District 2 thing a typo?
No, that's actually accurate. At that time, the state was divided into five districts, and District 2 encompassed part of Region 2 over near the Anaconda area, and it spanned Region 3 and into Region 5. So at the time, the district was broader than the region. The legislature added two new commissioners and then divided the state and the commission by region. So now I am the Region 3 commissioner, but I had been appointed the District 2 commissioner.
Enlighten our listeners to what your current Region 3 territory involves.
Well, pretty much from the Idaho and Wyoming border across the Absaroka Range to about Springdale, Montana, along the Yellowstone River. And then it heads up north into the belt, north of Helena, and then follows the Continental Divide down around the Big Hole to the Idaho border again, if that helps.
And your region borders on Yellowstone National Park.
That's correct.
Wild Earth Guardians and Project Coyote having filed suit against the state of Montana and the Montana Fish and Wildlife Commission. What has been the response from the commission?
I have to admit, silence. Until you contacted me, I wasn't even aware that a suit had been filed against the commission. So I've been pretty much kept in the dark and haven't heard any official position from the commission nor the department.
One more question about how the commission is composed. Is it set terms, or how does that work?
Terms are set in statute to be 4 years, and they're set to be staggered so that a term like my term, which spanned two different gubernatorial administrations, that my term endures into the next administration. They added two to the commission. Those two new positions were given staggered terms as well. So at any given time, one governor might appoint a suite, and then some of those commissioners will last into the next administration. However, in our case, with the legislative changes and the administrative changes, I ended up being the only surviving commissioner. The Montana State Senate refused to approve of Andrew McKean, who had been appointed prior to the change in administration. So interestingly, in the Jan Forte administration, he's been able to appoint six commissioners.
So that's six commissioners out of seven, and you were the lone one he has not appointed. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Jan Forte will have appointed the whole commission. Has that ever happened before, that one governor has done that?
Well, I guess in a sense, the Bullock administration, over time, as the commissioners termed out, I guess Steve Bullock had appointed all five of us, but not all at once. And so this is really unusual that the governor would have such a large footprint on the commission so suddenly.
And that was over two terms, not the first year, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And when is your term finished?
My term will finish upon either the governor appoints a new one in December or January, and that person is approved by the Senate. So it could be as early as the December 31st, or depending on how fast the governor wants to replace me.
Adequately monitoring wildlife populations, and particularly apex predators like wolves, can be difficult. We spoke earlier with Greg Lemon, and he explained about integrated patch occupancy modeling, IPOM, and that it replaced the earlier patch occupancy modeling, POM.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what model was used before those became the models and why this new model was adopted?
Well, I think in the earlier phases of wolf management, starting around 2002, 2003, in preparation for delisting, we relied on much more on-the-ground monitoring, where we had people out on the ground scattered across the state in wolf habitat, lots of radio collars on wolves. And so it was much more empirical in the sense that it was actual field data. What models they used prior to the patch occupancy model is kind of beyond my reckoning. I just do not recall the official names, but we had much more empirical data.
Can you comment on how changing the model has affected your ability to do your work on the commission?
I am a biologist by training before I became a lawyer. And so I tend to think of models as a useful way to test theory, right? Or to test different approaches. I don't really feel like they're precise or meant to be precise or accurate. There's always a room of margin of error, and each model gets better and better over time. So in a very practical scientific sense, the IPOM model hasn't fully matured to the point where we could consider it precise. So as a commissioner, what is more useful is to look at the population data, harvest data, acknowledging there's a margin of error around the estimates. What's happening in the trend in the population over time? And so that to me makes more sense than just claiming that we have exactly 1,150 wolves in the state. There's always a margin of error around that.
It seems as if the number of licenses that are being offered keep going up for wolves. But this is in the context, as you just mentioned, in an evolving model that may or may not be accurate.
Right. And I think that captures kind of the messiness of wildlife management. When you have a legislature that was bent on killing more wolves, you have a population of hunters and trappers, some of which want to hunt for wolves and trap wolves. And then you have the political overtones of cross-jurisdictional boundaries, Yellowstone Park versus out of the park. So the complexity of all those things, law rolled in with legislative mandates, rolled in with biology, means that the IPOM model is just meant to be a tool. It's not meant to be an absolute measure on the number of populations. Likewise, when the legislature says you have to give out more permits, that doesn't necessarily translate into vastly more hunter or trapper success, because hunters and trappers tend to limit their own take to what they want. There's actually only a handful of Montanans, or even non-residents, who come to Montana who want to fill their full 10 wolf quota, or their 10 wolf egg limit, or 20 wolves if you're a trapper. People limit their own take to a few. There's very few people that take more than one wolf. So like IPOM, there's not a precise number. Like giving out a certain number of permits, there isn't a certain output that will come from that harvest. So So in that great storm of information, whether it's IPOM estimating the number of wolves out there, the legislature saying you have to kill more wolves, and the biologists on the ground saying, well, here's some parameters with which to work. Our fundamental goal as commissioners should be to maintain a healthy long-term wolf population. I feel like no matter what the legislature said, and no matter how many permits were given out, the number of hunters out there on the ground, many unwilling to use these methods that were forced upon us, will keep a long-term healthy population around.
So you are less concerned that too many wolves are being killed. Is that true?
Well, I think that was the outcome of last year's hunting season, where all these new methods were forced through by the department and by the legislature. And between weather and just hunter behavior, people weren't willing to kill 450 wolves. Now, site-specifically, that didn't apply in places like hunting districts 313 and 316 on the park boundary, where there's a significant impact on those packs in that transboundary region. So the state's approach now is in gross, look at the wolf population in total, and using science and annoying politics, try and arrive at a number that will sustain the population long term.
That brings up the issue of changing from wolf management units to trapping districts, except for what had been wolf management units 313 and 316, the ones that are bordering Yellowstone National Park. How do you feel about the change from wolf management units to trapping districts?
Yeah, on a very practical level, changing the language from wolf management to trapping districts is largely semantical. I mean, as a matter of just on the groundwork, it didn't have a huge change. But what it did is ignited a lot of passion, because what it meant was we're not going to manage wolves as wolves. We're going to manage them as fur bearers. That was more disturbing than the kind of administrative name we put on those areas. I thought it was a political misstep, because I don't believe that wolves should be managed as fur bearers. They're a different creature altogether. But practically speaking, whether we call it Wolf Management Unit 3 or Trapping District 3, doesn't have a huge practical change. What it does mean is that we're managing under a set of wolf regulations that are kind of being blended in with the fur bearer, the trapping regulations, which I guess I'm not all that comfortable with.
And what about the quota or no quota issue?
Well, I think that was another big mistake. I mean, well before I was on the commission, that quota was hard fought and negotiated between a big variety of people. And then the new commission came in and kind of, what I believe, misreading the legislative mandate, decided to just dispense with it altogether, which resulted in a very high and disproportionate harvest across the region in that transboundary Yellowstone Park area. So the result was kind of a failure of wildlife management. And that cut both ways. In one sense, it had a large impact on the northern Yellowstone wolf packs. But it also ended up closing the season earlier for the rest of the state. So it did not meet the goal of the department and the commission to manage wolves across a broader landscape. It actually caused more problems than it solved.
How would you like to see that problem resolved? Can you speak to a way of doing it better?
Well, I think we did much better this year by reestablishing a quota of 6, which was based on some good science out of the park and the Park Service's position. I viewed the science a little different in that I proposed a motion to reduce those quotas down to 4, which is more like it was when I came on the commission, as a sustainable level where it wasn't so impactive on either the resident wolf population north of the park or park resident wolves.
Can you speak to the spirit behind the current regulations?
Well, I think what we're talking about is some different things. We're talking about the political approach, which I believe is based on this mythology that wolves are voracious predators that are killing off all our wildlife. That's the political side. I think on the conservation side, you'd find that many, if not most, Montanans, whether they're hunters or trappers or just wildlife watchers, don't view wolves through that lens. That we're probably more similar to our indigenous brothers and sisters, and that we respect them as an important part of the ecosystem, as an important part of our wildlife across the state. Politically, though, they became a football, right? It's the liberals against the real people, or poor ranchers being eaten out of house and home against the voracious wolves. And it's just an expression of these highly divisive politics that most Montanans, I think, are sick of. By and large, Montanans, hunters and anglers and trappers, would love the opportunity to enjoy a fair chase hunt for a wolf. But they're not out there trying to kill everyone that moves. And that's really seems to be the thrust of the legislature, is get out there and kill off these wolves. Well, it's not really in step with Montanans, our ethics or our attitude toward wildlife. In some places, up around Glacier Park, the general sentiment is like, we don't hate wolves. We don't want to kill them off. But we're worried that our elk populations and deer populations are being suppressed by wolves and cougars and other predators, grizzlies. So they're worried about the health of the wildlife. But they're not telling me that we got to eradicate them. That's a myth created by political operatives trying to drive a wedge between Montanans.
I have a theory of the cultural aspect of it manifested through fairy tales like Little Red Riding Hood and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. How much do you think that contributes to it?
I think that's a very good read on this, is that some people believe that wolves are inherently evil. And that's what drives the political side of the equation. But when I talk to ranchers who have had their livestock attacked by wolves, or people who love to watch wolves, or you know, people that are scared of them but like to have them around, and then there's just people that love to have them around, I don't hear a lot of that vehement hate for wolves, except for in political rhetoric. Maybe I'm naive, but I talked to a lot of people and I read, 26,000 comments or roughly about wolves. And boy, the number of people who hate wolves or want to see them eradicated from the earth are very small. And one of them happens to be a legislator. You know, I believe that most Montanans, wherever you are on the political spectrum, really care about our wildlife, really love our wildlife and want it to be healthy. And I think most Montanans don't want it to be a political football. And so I hope that most Montanans will remind their political leaders that this isn't something to be trifled with. Let's focus on the pillars of wildlife management. Let's focus on public participation, open dialogue about our wildlife values. Let's focus on scientific wildlife management and get away from this vilifying individual species that are all part of a larger ecosystem. Keeping the ecosystem healthy should be our number one goal. And I think most Montanans agree with that.
Well, Pat Byorth, Third Region Commissioner on the Fish and Wildlife Commission, thank you very much for joining us today on Ecotones. You have been really helpful to our understanding of these issues.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, Joy.
Michael Wasagijig Price, you are of the Anishinaabe people. I must add that you received your master's degree of science in forestry from the University of Montana. We hope you can help us gain a better understanding of the Native American perspective of right relationship to predators and particularly wolves. So thank you for mm-hmm. joining us today on Ecotones.
Well, I say miigwech, and thank you for inviting me to chat with you today. Uh-huh.
In September of 2021, six tribes in Wisconsin filed a lawsuit about wolf hunting. Can you very briefly tell us about that?
I'm not the legal expert on that case, but I do know that the state of Wisconsin has an obligation to consult with the federally recognized tribes within the state of Wisconsin, which they failed to do pertaining to this wolf hunt. It was a very blatant kind of a dismissal of consulting with the local tribes on this issue. So naturally, it was pretty offensive to the tribal leaders and the people of all the Ojibwe Anishinaabe tribes here.
And according to the newspaper article, the Wisconsin Natural Resource Board approved a quota of 300 wolves, and that was more than double the quota of 130 proposed by the Department of Natural Resources. The article goes on to say that it was a recommendation that was considered by experts to be too high and not supported by scientific data and analysis. What I'm hoping that we can discuss is just the culture behind these two different approaches, the tribal approach and the political dominant European approach. Could you speak, Michael, to how people in your tribe regard wolves?
Yes, I can do that. But before I start, I just want to say that I am Anishinaabe, and I speak for myself. I don't speak for all the Anishinaabe people from all of the 11 federally recognized tribes within Glyphwic. However, I can articulate some of the cultural components to our relationship. We call the wolf Maingan in our language. So the wolf is very much a part of who we are and how we see ourselves as Anishinaabe people. The wolf goes all the way back to our creation story. When first human was placed on the earth by Gijimanidu, the Great Spirit, and because he grew very lonely on the earth, the Great Spirit sent down a companion, and that companion was Maingan. And together, Anishinaabe and Maingan traveled the landscape, naming all the mountains and the rivers and the plants and the trees and the animals. And when they completed that journey, the Great Spirit said to both of them, "Your journey is complete. Now you both will walk separate paths and you will not walk together anymore, but always remember that you are relatives since the beginning." And so that's how we see Maingan, the wolf, as being our closest relative in the animal world. And many people, those people that really hold the traditional values dear to them, have that kind of spiritual, cultural relationship with Maingan. And of course, there are people that don't. I mean, there's a whole spectrum between the people who are connected and the people who are not connected to these cultural insights. But also from our cultural teachings, we don't see the wolf as a villain or as a bad omen. We see the wolf as a teacher, and we learn a lot of things from the behavior of the wolf. We learn a lot of things like family values, because a wolf pack is a family and we watch how they live together. We also learn the values of extended family, because the wolves actually will take care of other parents within the pack. They'll take care of their children as they go out to hunt. And then we learn the value of cooperation. It's very rare that a wolf can take down a deer and definitely not be able to take down an elk or a buffalo. But if they work together cooperatively, wolves can bring down these big game prey so they can feed their entire family. So we learn a lot of these values just from the wolf being themselves, and they're very much a part of our cultural ways.
Among the reasons given by those who are proponents of wolf killing is that they kill too many of the prey species that humans want to hunt for food or whatever, like the deer and the elk. Now, your people have been here from the depths of time. How did they consider the needs of wolves to hunt versus their own needs to hunt?
Well, our relationship to wolves is that we had respect for them and we allowed them to live the way that they had always lived. And yes, we do share a common food source, which is deer in this region in Wisconsin and Minnesota. But here at Glyphwic, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, we have both cultural knowledge people and also scientists working together. And we have found that there is little to no data saying that wolves denigrate deer herds. In fact, if anything, they may make them healthier, because wolves, as we have learned, that wolves can identify sick or wounded or aging deer in the herd. And those are the ones that they predate on. In fact, we have here in Wisconsin a disease called chronic wasting disease, CWD. And there is evidence to suggest in the scientific community that wolves actually do a better job of identifying deer infected with CWD better than humans can. And they predate on those deer. So in effect, the wolves are actually keeping the deer herd healthier by pulling the wounded and the sick deer from the herd. And that scientific finding coincides with our beliefs that we should allow the wolf to determine their own range and their own territories and let them regulate their own numbers rather than humans intervening and disrupting the ecosystem. So I want to tell another teaching that's in our Anishinaabe community. And that teaching is, Ani nejuwe bezid maingan mige ejuwe bezid Anishinaabe midash. Ani nejuwe bezid Anishinaabe mige ejuwe bezid maingan. And what that means is that whatever happens to the Anishinaabe happens to the wolf. Whatever happens to the wolf happens to the Anishinaabe. This is a teaching that's been passed down through generations in our Ojibwe and our Anishinaabe communities. And this story goes all the way back to colonization. When the first Europeans started coming over into the New World, the two things that they were fearful of is, one, the wolves that they heard howling in the woods, and also, two, the native people who they found very strange. And through the whole process of colonization, there became a struggle between the people that were pushing westward, and they were obliterating the wolves because they feared them, because a lot of the settlers were herders. And also, too, they were pushing westward and confronting the tribes. And over time, as they waged war against the wolves, they also waged war against the indigenous peoples. And this all culminated in the mid-1800s when there was a bounty system that were placed on wolves, I think beginning in 1865. And this was also the time of the Indian Wars that were going on between the government and the tribes out west. And so what happens to the wolf happens to the Anishinaabe. So as the wolves were being pushed to extinction, Native people and their cultures were being decimated. And finally, after the wars were over, Native children were taken from their families and placed into boarding schools so as to be forced assimilated. And also, too, at the same time, more and more programs for wolf extermination was going on across the country until nearly all the wolves were exterminated from the lower 48, except for a small pocket of land in northeastern Minnesota and in the upper peninsula of Michigan. By the 1920s, wolves were extinct in many states, and also the Native people came to an all-time low population of about 250,000. And, of course, the persecution still kept on going. In the early 1940s and 50s was the time of what we call the termination era, when the United States Congress was trying to obliterate the tribal obligations that they had towards the tribes. And also, too, the wolves were being pushed more and more and more towards extinction. And then something happened around the 1960s. There was a new consciousness. There was a new fire that was burning in Native people. The Native people started getting politically active, and they started fighting for their rights as tribes and as for individuals. And also along about that same time, people began to recognize that the wolf was pushed to near extinction. And so people started taking action to protect them. So now there's an upswing now. Both Native people and the wolves were pushed to the very bottom of existence, and then they started making a comeback. In the 1960s and 70s was a great time for the tribes. Many laws were passed, like the Self-Determination Act and the American Indian Religious Freedom Act and the American Indian Higher Education Act. And these were all throughout the early 70s. And at that same time, in 1973, the federal government passed the Endangered Species Act. And the wolf was one of the first species put on there that gained federal protection. So now from the 70s on forward, now the tribes began to expand. They started building tribal colleges. They started fixing their roads and hospitals. And at the same time, the wolves were making a comeback in several states in the north. And so we see that what has happened to the Anishinaabe people has also happened to the wolf. And throughout these last 250 years, we've watched our fates move together. And so now, today, we have a lot of vibrancy in the Native community. We have immersion schools. Our languages are coming back. Our ceremonies are coming back. The wolves are coming back to a healthy population in Wisconsin and in Minnesota. And then all of a sudden, last year, this horrific wolf hunt that happened in Wisconsin. And it reminded us, as Anishinaabe people, as we watched those wolves being slaughtered and being chased down by hounds and being chased by snowmobiles and being persecuted, we remembered what happens to the wolf happens to the Anishinaabe, and what happens to the Anishinaabe happens to the wolf. And so we're very vigilant right now about what's going on with the wolf, and we are prepared to fight in court for the protection of the wolf. So I wanted to share that teaching with you because it's a very strong story that exists among our people.
Any final words before we have to say goodbye?
No, I really thank you for inviting me to chat about our relative. And I just want to say that, you know, I work for an organization called the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. And we do believe in the sovereignty of all living beings, including the wolf. And we believe that the wolf should be able to determine their own range and their own population levels. And once we start showing respect to the natural world like that, we believe that our ecosystems, our forests, everything will come back to life and will come back to vibrancy. So, aho, miigwech. Thank you.
You have just heard interviews with Lizzie Pennock, an attorney with Wild Earth Guardians, Greg Lemon, administrator of FWP's Communication and Education Division, Pat Byarth, Montana Fish and Wildlife Commissioner for Region 3, and Michael Wasagijig Price of the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, discussing the lawsuit filed by Wild Earth Guardians and Project Coyote on October 27, 2022, in Montana State state court, alleging that the state's wolf hunting and trapping policies violate the Montana Constitution, the Montana Administrative Procedure Act, the public trust doctrine, and several federal laws meant to protect wildlife on federally managed lands. You can find out more by going to wildearthguardians.org and fwp.mt.gov. Links to articles can be found at kgvm.org/programs/ecotones. The Gallatin Valley was once a common gathering and hunting ground of the Blackfeet, the Crow, the Salish, the Shoshone, and the Kootenai, among the Two-Legs, as well as wolves, buffalo, bears, and others among the Four-Legs. We acknowledge that this land was taken from them during European settlers' westward expansion, and we value each of them who teach us to honor this sacred land today. Ecotones is a Beyond the Deep End production produced by Joy LaClaire for broadcast and archiving on Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman, streaming and archiving on the web at kgvm.org.